This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, August 23rd, 2017.
Wow. What a crowd. What a crowd.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks so much for joining us. Tuesday night, Donald Trump ventured out of Washington and back into his comfort zone. A campaign-style rally, this time in Phoenix, Arizona.
As everybody here remembers, this was the scene of my first rally speech, right? The crowds were so big, almost as big as tonight, that the people said right at the beginning, you know, there's something special happening here.
The main target over the course of the night?
It's time to expose the crooked media deceptions and to challenge the media for their role in fomenting divisions. The media can attack me, but where I draw the line is when they attack you, which is what they do. These are really, really dishonest people, and they're bad people. And I really think they don't like our country. I really believe that.
The location, a state the president won by less than 4 points last November, allowed him to focus on his tough immigration policies, including the border wall that's been at the center of his message to voters.
Now, the obstructionist Democrats would like us not to do it, but believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall.
But it was also his first major public appearance since his response to Charlottesville, which sparked fierce criticism and amplified divisions within the country. He did not back down.
I hit him with neo-Nazi. I hit him with everything. I got the white supremacists, the neo-Nazi. I got them all in there. Let's see. Yeah, KKK. We have KKK. I got them all.
On Monday, Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton urged the president not to hold the rally so soon after Charlottesville, saying America is hurting, and it is hurting largely because Trump has doused racial tensions with gasoline. But even after that message was delivered and thousands of protesters marched outside the rally, the event went on. Jimmy Jenkins is senior field correspondent for KJZZ in Phoenix and was at the rally last night. He joins me now. Jimmy, welcome.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me.
Along with overnight coverage of how the president said what he said, I think we're in danger of losing some of the important things he did say during the night. He talked a little bit about Joe Arpaio, who's been convicted of malfeasance during his time in office as the sheriff of Maricopa County.
Was Sheriff Joe convicted for doing his job? That's what... He should have had a jury, but you know what? I'll make a prediction. I think he's going to be just fine, okay?
Jimmy Jenkins, that's a broad hint.
Yes, and this is piggybacking on what we had heard from when he was interviewed by Fox News earlier in the month. He said, you know, he praised the former sheriff's tough immigration stance and said he thought he deserved a pardon. And then last night, so everyone in the media, everyone locally, this was a really big issue for a lot of people here because so many people have been focused on this case, you know, for so long, so much time, energy, money has gone into it. So when we heard earlier in the day that there was going to be no statement on this pardon, left a lot of people wondering. But then right off the bat, the president asked the crowd, is anyone here a fan of Joe Arpaio? And of course, everyone went crazy.
By the way, I'm just curious. Do the people in this room like Sheriff Joe?
Sheriff Arpaio was defeated here last year in his attempt at a seventh term, but he still has big supporters. Jessica Heron of Phoenix explains why she thinks the sheriff was wrongly accused.
Because he's protecting us in Arizona from illegal immigration. It's illegal immigrants that's the problem, not legal immigrants.
Jimmy, a lot of time was spent bashing people who do what you and I do for a living. But there was a throwaway line, what almost was a throwaway line, about the United States leaving one of its most significant economic relationships, its trade deal with Canada and Mexico.
Yeah, he said he would not be afraid to just terminate it or renegotiate NAFTA.
Personally, I don't think we can make a deal because we have been so badly taken advantage of. They have made such great deals, both of the countries, but in particular Mexico, that I don't think we can make a deal. So I think we'll end up probably terminating NAFTA at some point. Okay, probably. But I told you from the first day, we will renegotiate NAFTA or we will terminate NAFTA. I personally don't think you can make a deal without a termination, but we're going to see what happens, okay? You're in good hands, I can tell you.
There were so many of those throwaway lines, like you said, Ray. We were all over the place. Yeah, NAFTA, clearly, he said, is on the table. He said he would not be afraid to shut down the federal government to get the border wall built.
Build that wall. Now, the obstructionist Democrats would like us not to do it, but believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall.
Even brought up North Korea one time. So there was a lot of things that we had to keep an eye on. And like you said, it was just constantly being bombarded as we were doing the job of recording all this by, you know, all these attacks on the media, but nothing we haven't heard before.
Senators Jeff Flake and John McCain both came in for some criticism, if not necessarily by name, but it didn't seem to be unpopular in the hall.
Yeah, there's a lot of Trump supporters have, been critics of John McCain and Senator Flake. They say that, they don't go far enough. They're not true conservatives or true Republicans in the sense that they like to see Donald Trump out there fighting for them. But the strange thing was that the president told us, he kept saying that they don't want me to say their name. They don't want me to say their name. But he kept hinting at these obvious senators. He kept saying, we lost health care by just one vote, obvious reference to McCain. He said, your other senator is weak on immigration and, kept taking digs at Flake.
One vote away. I will not mention any names. Very presidential, isn't it? Very presidential. And nobody wants me to talk about your other senator who's weak on borders, weak on crime, so I won't talk about him.
He wouldn't call them out by name, so it led us to believe that maybe he was actually listening to, someone in the party or an advisor who's telling him to tone it down a little bit. But yeah, pretty obvious who he was talking about.
We've only got about half a minute left. Was there a lot of effort put into keeping the crowd inside the hall separate from the one outside?
There was actually. It was different than previous Trump appearances here in the Valley. Throughout the night, there was a huge separation. It was just at the end, like when things are always so complicated, a lot of people streaming out of the convention center that they did come into contact with protesters. A few skirmishes, but only 4 arrests and no major injuries. So that's a great thing here for Phoenix.
Jimmy Jenkins is senior field correspondent for KJAZZ, KJZZ in Phoenix. Thanks a lot, Jimmy.
My pleasure, Ray.
The president didn't seem to be speaking to many outside of his base last night in Phoenix, but even as his approval ratings have declined and GOP leaders have publicly questioned his leadership, the Republican National Committee continues to rake in donations. In 2017, the RNC has raised $62 million, while the DNC has taken in only $32.5 million or so. So what's working so well for the GOP? Ryan Williams is a Republican strategist and former spokesman for Mitt Romney's 2008 and 2012 presidential campaigns, and he joins me now. I guess being the party in charge of all the marbles, Ryan, works.
It certainly does. Being in power is a very powerful fundraising tool, and the Republican National Committee has vastly outraised the Democrats, which I think is in part to the fact that there is a lack of trust in the DNC, that the Democratic base seems to be upset with the leadership there after the way that they perceive the DNC rigged the system for Hillary Clinton. So I think there's a bit of an apathy towards the DNC, but the RNC is bringing in money, I think, largely because we have control of the Congress, we have control of the White House, and donors are interested to be a part of that by giving money to the National Committee.
Even in the face of a lot of discouraging news.
Yes, and I think that's due in large part to the hope that we, if we have a well-funded political apparatus, we can get some things done here with the control of the White House and the Congress. I'm not so sure that's going to work given the behavior of the president, but donors are interested in giving when there's a chance at you know, accomplishing political goals that they support. So that's why I think we've seen such significant fundraising numbers for the RNC.
The Republican National Committee is something quite apart from President Trump. He's just not a party guy historically. Does that change things? Does that make it difficult to keep the lines of communication clear and sort of the what's what clear as the party looks ahead to a 2018 midterm and gets ready eventually for 2020?
Well, you're right about the fact that Donald Trump is not really a party guy. He was a Democrat who has taken a variety of different positions that vary from the traditional Republican base issues. But when you're the president, you're the leader of the party. The RNC serves President Trump, and the RNC is altering itself to fit his agenda and his positions. And that puts, I think, the RNC not at a difference with Trump. I think it puts them at a difference with some of the members of Congress who are more traditional Republicans. They are going to toe the Trump line. So, you know, this spat we've seen over the Confederate monuments in Charlottesville, the RNC is not criticizing President Trump, and they probably never will because they serve the president.
You use that word non-traditional, and I recall that last night the president did something very unusual. It's normal protocol for presidents of all parties to sort of stay out of state races until the situation is clarified by a primary. Donald Trump, for whatever reason, is not following this tradition.
One vote away, I will not mention any names. Very presidential, isn't it? Very presidential. And nobody wants me to talk about your other senator, who's weak on borders, weak on crime, so I won't talk about him.
Trump has publicly called out Senator Jeff Flake, and here, without mentioning his name, and drawn attention to one of his fringe primary opponents. How unusual is it for a sitting president to go after a senator from his own party in this way?
It's unheard of, not just to get involved in a primary race, but to openly target a sitting member of the Senate, even if there are disagreements. Presidents before have realized that it's in their best interest to have as many members of their party in office, and the best way to do that is to get your incumbents reelected. This is so counterproductive when you control all houses of Congress and you have a Republican president in the White House to focus on petty inter-party fights instead of working with your members on the Hill to advance an agenda. It does not seem the president is capable of doing that.
He is, to continue on the untraditional thread, running for re-election, as legally he was running for re-election almost from the time he took the oath of office for his first term. Apart from the politics of it and apart from the novelty of it, is it good for fundraising, for energizing the Republican base to have a president who 7 months in is already running for re-election?
I think it's good for fundraising and revving up the base in the short term, but it's bad for him in the long term. People want to see their presidents get results. And when the president is holding campaign rallies, not focused on doing the job of governing this early in his term, we're only 6-7 months into this term, it really hurts your ability to drive a legislative agenda. And if you have no accomplishments to run on down the road in 4 years, that makes re-election very, very difficult. I think that the president is doing these rallies not out of any kind of strategy. I think it just makes him feel good. I think that's why they put him out here to do these rallies. This rally last night really made no sense politically. The president had just given the night before a very somber and, by Trump standards, a fairly serious speech on Afghanistan policy. And he comes out the next day and steps all over his message and ruins it with this kind of off-the-rails campaign rally that meanders from one controversial statement about Confederate statues to pardoning Sheriff Arpaio to attacking Jeff Flake. It makes no sense politically. It gets his base revved up, but if he's going to improve his numbers right now, his favorability numbers, which are very low at this point for a first-term president, he needs to go beyond the base, and this does nothing, these rallies, to do that.
That's Ryan Williams. He's a Republican strategist, the former spokesman for Mitt Romney's 2008 and 2012 presidential campaigns. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
This week, the director of the Secret Service, Randolph Alls, released a statement saying the agency has enough money to operate through the end of September, but already over 1,000 agents have hit the federal caps for yearly salary and overtime, leaving hundreds without compensation for the rest of 2017. The costs are partially attributed to the president and his family's busy travel schedule. During President Trump's first 7 months in office, he's taken 5 trips to his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, 1 trip to Trump Tower in Manhattan, and 7 trips to Mar-a-Lago, Florida, each one of those trips south costing more than $3 million each. Protection for the president's globetrotting adult children also rack up some pretty significant costs. In January, the Washington Post reported Eric Trump's expenses for a stay in Uruguay left a bill of nearly $100,000 in hotel rooms for the Secret Service and embassy staff. And all of those costs are starting to catch up to the Secret Service.
This is not an unusual event, but it's one that has continually occurred for the last 25 years or so, where we have agents that are coming up against their maxed out payment for the year.
James Mottola was a special agent with the Secret Service between 1988 and 2014, and this is a problem he directly experienced. While the compensation issue usually comes up in campaign years, he says it goes beyond the unique challenges of the current administration.
Now, I think we have to take into account a number of factors. The first factor is that, although not a campaign year, we have had an inauguration this year. The Secret Service has also picked up another protectee and their family, which is the Obama family. So we've got the former presidents, which are Carter, Bush, Clinton's Bush and Obama, as well as the service protects the Secretary of Homeland Security, as well as the Secretary of Treasury. And of course, this is not the first time that the Secret Service has had to protect this many adults of a sitting president. For instance, back in the early 90s, during the Gulf War, the Secret Service had protection for George Bush, Jeb Bush, Neil Bush, Dorothy Bush, and Marvin Bush. And they were in 3 different states. So this has happened before. But one of the interesting things that has occurred over the years with the Secret Service, and a lot of it has had to do with funding issues, is that the Secret Service has not been able to hire as many agents as it's needed to replenish the agents that are leaving for attrition or for other issues.
This current president travels a great deal, is away from the White House a great deal. Does this drive costs?
Of course, every president has his own traveling tempo, if you will. Trips outside the White House do cost, of course. But I think that, you know, if we look back even from the Bush to the Clinton era, there was significant travel during the Clinton era by President Clinton. And of course, every president has their own priorities, and we shouldn't dictate to the president where they go and when they go based upon cost alone. So the service's mission is to make sure that the president is safe no matter where he goes. The costs, the service really looks at it from a risk-based approach. They make decisions based on financial oversight with really meticulous oversight in order to make sure that it's cost-effective in every way possible without sacrificing security.
The number of protectees, as you mentioned, has gone up from 31 during the Obama years to now 42 people with the addition of the Trump family. Does that leave the agency overstretched if, as you mentioned, they can't hire to fill that large a new set of requirements?
I don't believe that the agency is overstretched. I believe this is a funding issue. So I think the one thing the American public should know is that the service continues to do its job and its mission to protect its protectees, and they shouldn't be concerned about that. The fact is that this issue with compensation is really a congressionally mandated salary cap that affects supervisors and journeyman agents, specifically on the protective details, because those agents are working quite a bit of overtime, and they're not able to collect or receive the money that they earn during those periods of time because of this federally mandated cap.
Have you ever gone without pay or without overtime in the latter parts of a year?
As a matter of fact, yes, I have. This is something that frequently occurs, and for agents even assigned to field offices, it does occur where you have to perform your duties, and there is no compensation for those duties.
If you're being told by the fall, Well, you've made your money for the year, pal. I mean, it's hard to think of that happening in very many lines of work.
Well, you know, I think that this is something that agents understand that is possible to happen. It doesn't usually occur as extremely as we've seen during campaigns. And in periods of extreme travel, it certainly can be something that the agents must have to come to terms with. But I never thought that it ever impacted our ability to do the job or to conduct the mission as necessary. Unfortunately, it's one of those things that has not been changed, and I have to applaud Director Alice for trying to see if that can be pushed up to another level. I think that would, of course, greatly help, but it's certainly not going to hinder agents from doing their job.
If so many agents are hitting their caps this early in the year, might there be a problem structurally with the way we're managing this expenditure?
These expenditures are very difficult to manage. And forecasting, you can't predict the future. So, of course, I know that the Secret Service looks at this very closely and works within the department as well as with Congress to plan and to prepare better. Compensation and the max out or salary cap have been a consistent problem over the years. And it's probably something that Congress should take a look at. And I know there is support in Congress for this. And I hope that lawmakers are able to recognize this and work with the agency and the department to resolve this situation.
James Mottola was a special agent with the Secret Service between 1988 and 2014. He's now Director for Forensic Investigations and Risk Mitigation at Sobel & Company. James Mottola, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Since 2011, Boko Haram insurgents have waged a campaign against the Nigerian government and the country's citizens that's killed more than 20,000 people and forced millions from their homes. More recently, the group has been using children to carry out its deadly attacks. UNICEF reported Tuesday Boko Haram militants are increasingly using children to carry out suicide attacks in northeastern Nigeria at a rate four times higher this year than seen in all of 2016. Since January, at least 83 children were used as bombers, the majority of them girls under the age of 15. Ambassador John Campbell is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he joins me now. Ambassador, what's driving this alarming increase in the use of children?
It's being driven by the very success of the tactic. Using children and using suicide bombers in general is something which is relatively new. There is no tradition of the use of suicide to advance political interests in West Africa. And in fact, the first suicide bombing was as recent as 2011. The use of suicide bombers has gone through various stages. Last year, for example, there was a particular focus on the use of women. Part of that is because female traditional dress in northern Nigeria made it possible to hide bombs. In a sense, the same is true with children. It's unlikely that a child going into a market is going to be subject to the same kind of scrutiny than an adult will be.
Do we know about the tactic, about what happens before a child wanders into a marketplace? Do they know what they're doing? Have they been trained, or are they being duped?
We don't know very much. We really don't. My own view is that there is probably a range of motivations. Some, I suspect, have been brainwashed. Some have been convinced that by carrying out the suicide act, the gates of paradise will open. Some literally are coerced into doing it. I suspect it's a whole range. But it's remarkable how little we actually know. about how suicide bombers are chosen, how they're trained, and what their motivation is.
In the short time we have left, less than a minute, what do we know about popular support in northeastern Nigeria for the aims of Islamic militant groups like Boko Haram? The depravity of using children as suicide bombers, has that lessened public support?
There's no particular evidence that it has. The degree of popular support for Boko Haram is debatable. At least one Nigerian intelligence officer was quoted in the media last week as saying that in the city of Maiduguri, perhaps a third of the population was sympathetic to the aims and goals of Boko Haram. In other words, whatever the degree of support or lack thereof Boko Haram has, there is enough support that it can probably continue for a very long time.
That's Ambassador John Campbell of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Voters in Angola go to the polls today to elect a new president. It's the first time the country will get a new leader in 38 years. President José Eduardo dos Santos was sworn in 1979, making him the world's second longest serving president behind the leader of Equatorial Guinea. Now dos Santos is stepping back. Many attribute the move to his poor health, though officials deny this is the cause. Zenaida Machado is Angola and Mozambique researcher in the Africa division at Human Rights Watch, and she joins me now. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there's been one party in charge since Angola won its independence from Portugal, and one leader. We know he's leaving, but will the MPLA still be running Angola after the votes are counted?
I think if you are on the side of the opposition, you would say that we hope that by tomorrow, the day after, when the results, the preliminary results are announced, the MPLA would have left power. But if you want to read things from a reality point of view, and if you consider the entire preparation for those elections, you consider the dominance of the ruling party, not necessarily the popularity, but the fact that they have used huge amount of state resources for their campaign. If you look at the state media coverage of these elections, you would see that they have 90% of chances of winning these elections. But as we all know, the vote is secret. Angolans are casting their vote today. It might happen that tomorrow, the day after, we'll be surprised.
Do Angolans directly elect their president?
No. I mean, the Angolan system says that the party that gets more votes is the one that wins the elections, and automatically the head of the list of MPs of that party becomes automatically the president.
So what should we know about José Eduardo dos Santos's designated successor, João Lourenço?
There isn't much publicly known about this man. What we know is a very shy man who was the Minister of Defense. He had to resign a month before the elections, when the campaign was about to start. And it was in that capacity that for the past few months, he has been replacing the president in all official events. He's very popular within the ruling party, somebody who is very well respected. There are not known many cases of him involved in scandals or corruptions. It could be that he doesn't have any, but it could also be that because he has never been in the public eye, we still don't know much of him. And now that if he becomes president, people will start investigating more of him.
Well, this gives us a chance to look back on the career of President dos Santos. He was the liberation struggle leader. He led the MPLA to victory against the Portuguese. In the years since, as he's been running Angola, oil wealth has poured into the country, and his own children have gotten extremely rich. Was he a good leader? Did he set the country on a good course?
It depends from where you are seeing it. If you look from the perspective of those Angolans who think that peace is the most important thing that Angola has ever had, then for those people, Dos Santos was a good leader because he was indeed the man who led the country to a peace deal that has been in place ever since it was signed. But if you look at it from the perspective of those who think that the wealth of Angola should have been distributed in a much fair way, for those who believe that a country should be run by not just one party and the state should not be confused with a political party, for those clear, this man has not been a very good leader.
When the oil price was high, money poured into Angola. Has it been tough now that crude oil is selling at much, much less money per barrel?
I think to say tough is underestimation. It's been very, 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 very bad. The price of basic food has gone up by 300% in some places. Construction of infrastructure has stopped literally in Angola. The local currency has gone down, has lost value against the US dollars or the rand, the South African rand. Basic health, and when I talk about basic health, I'm talking about you going to a hospital and being able to get a malaria medicine or get a nurse that is well prepared to take care of you. Those basic things are not there.
Even though for many observers the result is a foregone conclusion, do Angolans take their elections seriously? Are they eager participants in voting?
I mean, I told this to somebody else this morning that I've never seen Angolans so enthusiastic about elections. But I see Angolans more expectant, more hopeful. They do have the feeling that because the fact that President Dos Santos is no longer there, and when he was there, it was a default setting that this guy has to be president until he leaves. Now he's not there. So I think what is going on in the mind of Angolans is that feeling that anyone can be president now. The big guy is not here. Everybody is competing at the same level.
Zenaida Machado is Angola and Mozambique researcher in the Africa division at Human Rights Watch. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Ray Suarez. Welcome back to The Takeaway. All week we've been presenting stories from Youth Build USA, an organization working with disconnected young Americans. Yesterday we had a chat with people from a Youth Build charter school in Philadelphia, figuring out the challenges of training and educating in an urban environment. Today we'll get outside the city to talk about what it's like for young people trying to get ahead in a rural community.
I think one of the biggest challenges for young folks coming in is they've really been disconnected. They've been disconnected from a classroom. They're disconnected from the workforce. They're really struggling to get through life every day. And it may have been 3 or 4 or 6 years since they have actually opened up a book and been in a classroom.
That's Michelle Farris, program manager for Youth Build North Central in Elkins, West Virginia. Her work in Appalachia brings her in contact with young Americans struggling to meet their basic needs.
Sometimes they have medical problems. Sometimes they have dental problems. Their teeth hurt and they can't concentrate. They need eyeglasses. They haven't seen a doctor for a very long time. They're struggling with substance abuse. So we really spend some time up front trying to address those issues. And then these young folks start to see success.
And they do see success. William Gartman is a current student, and he can attest to Youth Build's comprehensive approach.
When I joined Youth Build, you know, I knew my family was there all along, and I'm just forever grateful for that. I've really felt the love since day one, and it hasn't faded away since.
Michelle Farris explained Youth Build's success in West Virginia, in an area that so often stands as a symbol of America's forgotten rural communities.
We have a great community that give them chances. We have a job shadow program. We are what's called a dual track Youth Build. We have a construction program. We also have a med prep program for the young people who do not think they're interested in construction. That's a really growing industry in the small area that we serve.
We talked about the Philadelphia program yesterday, and they have their set of challenges. What's different about a rural setting?
We cover three counties, three mountain counties, so that's 1,800 square miles. Transportation is a huge drawback for us. We don't have public transportation, so we have a contract with Country Road Transit. It's a local transportation company. They pick us up in the morning and pick up our crew and bring them to our doors by 7 a.m., and they come back again at 3 o'clock and deliver those young people back home.
William Gartman, was transportation a challenge for you?
Yeah, a little bit at first, but Youth Build got me right into the Country Ridge Transit and got me a bus pass and actually helped me, assisted a lot in getting my license, so now I don't have a problem with public transportation, luckily.
What brought you to Youth Build in the first place? What was your situation before they got you signed up?
Well, I dropped out of school in 2012, actually, but both of my brothers graduated the program, and the success that I saw them do led me to believe that I could do great things if I joined the program, too.
Wasn't the option there to finish high school? What stood in the way of you finishing?
Well, that's one of the problems of the rural areas. For instance, when I was in my algebra class, my algebra teacher didn't really know algebra very well and got a lot of his lessons from Google or YouTube, so that really played a hard role in how I learned algebra and wasn't very well before I entered Youth Build.
Michelle Farris, in an area that's surrounding Elkins, well, three counties, the 1,800 square miles you mentioned, there often aren't even enough jobs for the adults in the community. How do you connect young people with work when there's already significant challenge in the local economy?
They are excited about getting a job. By the time these young folks leave Youth Build, I think it gives them an edge. They're ready. They have a great work portfolio. They know how to interview. They can ace an interview. We talk a lot about being, you know, in the 2% of people who absolutely love the thing they do every day so it doesn't feel like work. And we hope that's what they're pursuing.
When I've reported in some of the least populated parts of the country, there's a tension in education and training programs between retaining these now better educated, more valuable young people, and letting them go. William, is that challenge sort of always in the back of your mind?
Yeah, a little bit, because in my situation, I want to go to culinary school when I finish up with Youth Build, but there aren't a lot of culinary schools in West Virginia, so yeah, I feel like Youth Build will do anything in their power to get me to that situation, and they've really, you know, stuck their neck out for me, and even though there may be that tension, I feel like they'll be proud of me no matter where I go, as long as I'm successful.
Michelle Farris, is there greater attention to the challenges of places like West Virginia? After this election, after all the national debate about places that have been forgotten and left behind, is it going to be a little easier to do the work that you do because you'll have more allies?
We spent a lot of time over the last 12 months doing advocacy calls, asking for our legislators to please not forget us. Joe Manchin, Shelley Moore Capito, Alex Mooney, they have all pledged to support us and keep this program going. There were some threats to cut AmeriCorps. I think that there were some cuts, but we still have an AmeriCorps grant, so our young people are able to work toward an educational award.
And finally, William, it sounds like you're much more optimistic about the future than if I had caught you right after you quit school.
Yeah, of course. Youth Build opened a lot of doors for me. They helped me get multiple certifications and showed me how to be a young leader in my community. And, you know, I'm very optimistic about the future because I have a lot of experience now and I know how to do things that I didn't before. So I've really discovered my self-value.
William Gartman is a current Youth Build North Central student. Good luck to you, William.
Thank you.
And Michelle Farris is the program manager for Youth Build in Elkins, West Virginia. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Youth Build is working to reach millions of disconnected youth across the country. What steps do you think could help?
My name is Michael, and I'm calling from Kutztown, Pennsylvania. Thinking outside the box should not be confined to space exploration and electric cars. human resources are being wasted, and those are the most precious and promising of all.
I work in a library where idle young people come to get resources to take the GED, or apply for jobs, or complete homework online. But we need to invest in early childhood education and education all the way through college. We need to fund apprenticeship programs for those kids at college for whom is a poor fit. We need to fund service programs that meet national needs and offer job preparation, leadership, and life skills. We need to support our kids as though they are our legacy, because gosh darn it, they are.
Do you see the effects of disconnected young people in your town? What should we do about it? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or join the conversation on the Takeaways Facebook page. Forty years ago, NASA launched the Voyager missions. Two space probes sent into space August 20th and September 5th, 1977. The Voyager spacecrafts were tasked with helping us learn more about our solar system, to see if there was life out there, and maybe let alien life know we were out here.
We cast this message into the cosmos. Of the 200 million stars in the Milky Way galaxy, some, perhaps many, may have inhabited planets and spacefaring civilizations.
That message, written by President Jimmy Carter, along with recordings, scientific formulas, songs, and sounds from Earth, are all part of the Golden Record, an Earthling collection of what astronomer Carl Sagan deemed the most important things for alien life to know about our home planet. The Voyager crafts are still traveling today. Voyager 1 even left our solar system for interstellar space 5 years ago, but still faithfully transmits back data about the universe beyond. In honor of their four-decade journey, a new documentary about the intrepid probes called The Farthest, Voyager in Space, airs on PBS tonight. Carolyn Porco is a planetary scientist who started working on the Voyager mission in 1983 and also led the imaging team for the Cassini mission, the first probe to enter Saturn's orbit. Carolyn is featured in tonight's documentary and says so much of what we've learned about the reaches of our solar system over the past four decades is thanks to Voyager.
When Voyager was conceived, we have to remember it was only the early days of the space program. And even in the most powerful telescopes that we had at the time, planets like Uranus and Neptune were nothing but tiny little dots. We knew almost nothing about them. We knew more about Saturn, but still vast areas we knew nothing about. We knew nothing about its rings. We knew Jupiter had four Galilean moons. I mean, moons discovered by Galileo, but it's remarkable what we didn't know and remarkable how wrong our impressions were. We thought the moons in the outer solar system would be geologically dead. There would be nothing going on there, nothing having had gone on there for billions of years. And then Voyager was launched in 1977, and it undertook this odyssey across the solar system, Homeric in style. And we find that it's an incredibly dynamic and rich place, and we have learned so much that has informed us about how the Earth has come to be, how our solar system has come to be, and even showed us that what we had traditionally thought of as the kind of environment that could give rise to life was so limited, and where life could arise, the environments where that would be possible are far more diverse than we ever had dreamed. And then, of course, remember, Voyager carries this record of us, of our music.
Go, Danny, go, go!
Our greetings.
Hartelijke groeten aan iedereen.
Siyani bingalela maqhawe.
Assalamu alaikum.
Johnny be good.
Pictures of our own planet. This message that says to the universe, we want you to know us even long after we're gone.
We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate.
And finally, Voyager enters into the interstellar medium and redefines us once again, not only as an interplanetary species, but now as an interstellar species. And for all these reasons, and the fact that Voyager opened up our solar system to us, really, I consider it the Apollo 11 of the planetary program. It has that kind of iconic stature.
You know, I think the thing that's so striking as I look back is that this really stood on the shoulders of very little. You were inventing from scratch. This team of brilliant scientists were making some educated guesses, taking some calculated risks, and inventing something that had no peer, had no predecessor that could be a reliable platform on which to base this new thing.
That's a beautiful way to put it. I've never heard anybody say this, standing on the shoulders of very little, and it's so true. It, in some cases, it was inventing things from whole cloth and inventing as we go along. That's what's so thrilling about space exploration and always pushing ourselves to a greater limit, always being at the very limit of human endeavor and human existence, is that, you know, it's all new and no one's ever done quite what you are about to do. And it pushes us also in technology, in communications. I mean, as you know, NASA has been at the forefront of much of the technology that we now use and take for granted. It was engineered and necessary to make possible the exploration of the solar system.
The photos that came not only from the planets themselves, but from the moons of Jupiter, Saturn, and the others, were striking, almost unbelievable, breathtaking, really. And I'm wondering if there's a part of us that's a little spoiled, where we have to sort of up the ante to get the gasp that we might have gotten in 1979, in 1989, in 2017. When I looked at the PBS special that marks the 40th anniversary of the launch of Voyager, the briefing rooms for you scientists were filled with reporters, and I'm wondering if they still would be so today, whether the ability to thrill and captivate is the same, the motive power of those images is the same. When we find out the next new big thing, will it enthrall us in the same way?
I think you're asking very good questions. I think it's human nature to be captivated by what is new. So once we pass that point, maybe it's not so thrilling anymore, but there certainly are still people who are very enthralled by what we've done in the exploration of Saturn, for example, with Cassini, who have been as excited as I have been to learn that there's a moon at Saturn called Enceladus that could harbor life because it has an ocean laced with organic compounds that is spraying into space in the form of 101 geysers. And Cassini has flown through this and told us that this is a place that could be inhabited. And you know, that's something that's not happened yet, right? We have not found evidence for life elsewhere beyond the Earth. And I can tell you that that is a topic that still very much grabs people. And it has grabbed humankind for thousands of years. And we could be on the verge of finding out, maybe with the next mission back to the Saturn system. So I think there is still going to be exciting, thrilling things for those planetary explorers who are yet unborn.
Carolyn Porco is a planetary scientist who's worked on the Voyager and Cassini missions. Great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Ray. Great to talk to you.
Carolyn Porco is featured in the new documentary, The Farthest, Voyager in Space. It airs tonight on PBS.
The Voyagers and every boy and girl. If you want to get to heaven, get out of this world. You're the Voyager. You're the Voyager.
That's all for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Ray Suarez. It's been great sitting in this week. Follow me at Ray Suarez News. Indira Lakshmanan will be in for the rest of the week. Todd Zwillick will be back Monday. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.